say KBOO Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tis the season for gift shopping, that is, and you've likely noticed that everything for the kids in your life says made in China. But that wasn't always the case. It used to be the other way around. Most of the toys were imported into China from foreign countries.
And so there's this real concern about finding, you know, a native Chinese toy that can be both modern, but also truly Chinese for our kids to play with. That was a big topic of conversation in the 1920s.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today, the gifts we buy. But first, the almighty power of the consumer. Remember when people refused to buy Goya food products after Goya's CEO praised Donald Trump? Or when thousands took their business elsewhere when Chick-fil-A donated to anti-LGBTQ groups? Meredith Katz is a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She says those boycotts are part of a larger history of consumer activism that dates all the way back to the Boston Tea Party. And now that social media has taken over the internet, she thinks consumer activism is more powerful than ever. Meredith, how far back does American consumer activism go?
So often, consumer activism is dated back to the Boston Tea Party and the American Revolution. So the Boston Tea Party was the political protest that really occurred in Boston, of course, right? About taxing tea. They dumped the tea into the harbor. Over 300 chests of tea they dumped into the harbor. And so that is really seen as kind of this first sight of consumer activism where they didn't like what was being imposed upon them. And so they decided to take a different course of action.
It's really interesting to think that this goes back that far. Mm-hmm. Did Americans or colonists at the time have to learn that this is a concept, this idea of boycotting?
I'm not sure they themselves would label it a boycott. I mean, this is the late 1700s, right? And here we are, right, 250-ish years later. And I feel like it's a term that we have kind of retroactively imposed upon what they did. But I don't think that it is something that they would have said, yes, this is a boycott.
And it wasn't a one-off. Years later, at least, Quakers used mm-hmm. the same sort of technique to lead mm-hmm. an effort to boycott goods that had been made by enslaved workers prior mm-hmm. to the Civil War.
Correct, yes. And so Quakers, driven a lot by their ideology, which is, I think, a parallel that we can see today by people who we would consider consumer activists, refused to buy products made of slave labor. And that is something that we see people boycotting now for similar purposes, whether or not it's, you know, sweatshops or if they are boycotting things that they believe, like the farmers are not being paid a fair wage. So again, I think it's important to realize that this is not something that happened in the distant past and stayed there, but really what we have is a trajectory of history spanning over 200 years.
After the Quaker boycott, let's say, post-Civil War, mm-hmm. what are some of the bigger movements you saw? You write about, for instance, the 1889 sweatshop movement mm-hmm. led by women.
Yeah, so at that point, the National Consumers League had a white label campaign, which is really a precursor to what we would call the anti-sweatshop movement today. And so what they did was they ensured that there was fair labor in making a product, and fair wages being paid to the workers on the floor. And then what they would do is they would literally put a white label on the tag. And when the white label was on the tag, then you as the consumer in the store were assured that fair labor and fair wages went into that product. And so you could buy that product with confidence.
Did that work?
It did. It was extremely successful, in part for two reasons. One, they had their act together and they did their research and it was a widespread campaign. And the second reason was that women tend to be the primary consumers at that time. And women were also the ones that were leading this movement. And so I feel like the solidarity that occurred between them there was really helpful in advancing their cause.
Years later, you point out that African Americans also played a prominent role in consumer activism with the Don't Buy Where You Can't Work movement. What was that?
So that was in the 1930s in Chicago. That was a movement really by African Americans themselves to say that we are not going to buy things, even if you were located in our neighborhood, if you are not going to hire us. So the flip side of this, right, is that when people boycott, they also boycott. While they weren't working or they were not purchasing, therefore, at certain stores, they went to Black-owned businesses. And so that became a thing, right? So they were not employable at these places, and so they would not patronize them. And so conversely, they were going to support Black-owned businesses.
Oh, so it bolstered the community.
Yes, yes. And that's one of the things about consumer activism. It's kind of two sides of the same coin, because sometimes when you're not shopping somewhere, you still have to shop somewhere else. And so by doing that, right, you're redirecting your money to a different place that maybe upholds your values or supports your community, or in this case, would even hire you.
There's another kind of consumer expression that you write emerged after World War II. What was that? How were people using purchasing to express themselves?
Right. So after World War II, this is where, again, we see the rise of choice. We now have mass manufacturing. We have a plethora of options that people didn't previously have. That's sometimes when we start to see the rise of people being able to express who they are through their consumer choices and habits. So, for instance, your style of dress, where you purchase, now you have a lot of choices. They're increasing availability for consumers to make those choices that reflect either who they want to be or who they want to present themselves as.
In more recent times, what brands have you noticed have been on the receiving end of maybe wide-scale consumer boycotts?
Right. There has been a boycott recently against the Goya products, the Hispanic food products, because the owner of Goya said that Trump was a blessing. There also, similarly, I think the Trump and everything surrounding him really sparked a lot of boycotts, including Publix, because a member of the Publix family recently donated to the rally right before the January 6th insurrection. Initially with Starbucks, there was some opposition because they did not want any of their employees during the Black Lives Matter movement to wear any signage or any pins or anything signifying their support. They later reversed that due to consumer and public pressure.
You know, you mentioned the protests over Donald Trump goods when he was president. Mm-hmm. I remember a group of people rushed to boycott Trump products, from wine to hotels and steaks and even his daughter's line of clothing. But also, Trump supporters rushed in to buy those very same goods.
Yes. And that's exactly what happens, right? So especially in something that is so politically charged as Donald Trump, right? You have groups of people boycotting something for the same reason that you have other groups of people boycotting or intentionally purchasing, right? So they want to show their support for Donald Trump. You know, they go to the Trump winery, or they go to Trump Tower, or they go buy Ivanka Trump's clothing line at the store. And so that's what we see. We see that often when we have a boycott for one reason, there's people on the other side that are going to support those people with their dollars because they want to show that they too agree with their ideology, or they don't want them to suffer so much from the boycott of others.
We're also right in the middle of that holiday period where we have a lot of consumer days that have been designated recently. So online, you've got Amazon Singles Day, Cyber Monday, Black Friday. Do you see much consumer backlash to that?
Right. So online sales are up 10% from last year, and they continue to rise. So it's kind of this revenge spending is a way that I've heard it called. So during COVID, maybe people, you know, bought things initially and then it kind of tapered off. So even though we're seeing inflation, we're still seeing, right, a really high level of consumer spending. And while there's all those examples, there's also other ones where people are saying no, right? Like REI famously has on Black Friday opt outside and they close all of their stores. Adbusters, which is a nonprofit out of Canada, actually, has deemed the Friday after Thanksgiving Buy Nothing Day, since it's notoriously the largest shopping day of the year before Cyber Monday came along. So I do think that there are these movements of people that are resisting this hyper-consumerism and just this idea to buy, buy, buy.
Has the use of buying power been much more pronounced by Americans through the years than Europeans?
Yes, in part because we are such a consumer-driven society. While these other societies, European societies, are, you know, also capitalist societies and also, you know, have interest in consumer goods, right? The scale at which Americans spend is like none other. And conversely, the scale at which we dispose of our items is like none other. And so in part, that really has created a space for consumer activism to flourish in the U.S.
Do you think that boycotting is still popular? Do you think most people still think it's an effective tool for achieving ethical ends?
I do. I think boycotting, if you were to ask a researcher, is something that's really hard to measure. So if you would say, how often do you boycott Chick-fil-A? Well, I don't know, because I just don't go to Chick-fil-A, right? And so I think it's a really hard concept to quantify, but there actually is some recent research out that shows that 63% of Americans believe it's effective. And so I do think there is a way in which people understand that where they spend their money matters.
What about you? Do you have your own form of consumer activism or expression during the holiday period?
That's a great question. I try to definitely not purchase from certain places. I do not shop at Amazon, for example, because I just believe Jeff Bezos has too much money and there's other ways that I can redirect my spending elsewhere in my local economy. I do not like to have a lot of stuff, even though I have a small child, so that's kind of hard. So I really try to ask myself, like, will I need this, right? Is this just the temporary high of maybe opening this as a gift or seeing somebody open this as a gift? Or is this something that's going to end up in a donation pile in a couple of months? I know we live in a consumer society and there's so many options and sometimes things feel kind of insurmountable in terms of corporate power, but you can make different choices. And I think it's also important to realize that you don't have to make all the different choices at once. Just start with one thing, right? Say, I want to buy, you know, coffee from a farmer that I know was paid a fair wage. And those small things really do collectively add up.
Meredith Katz, this is inspirational. Thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you.
Meredith Katz is a sociology professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. Coming up next, how Chinese toys over the years have impacted the identities of Chinese children. Whatever our age, we remember the toys we grew up playing with. Susan Fern Zebner is a professor of history at the University of Mary Washington. She says toys are also a matter of personal and national identity. For example, there was a period in China in the 1920s when the nation realized its children were playing with mostly foreign toys, and they quickly got to work on making toys that reflected their own children. Susan, when did you first start thinking about childhood toys and the way children play with toys really being a reflection of their identity, even their national identity?
I think it was the first time I saw this film entitled Playthings. It was one of several Chinese films I was watching from the 1930s. And I was just really struck by this image of toys themselves in this film. The film is about a woman who's a handicraft toy maker in village China. And she goes through a whole series of trials and tribulations, in addition to struggling to get her handicraft toys, you know, to compete with imported factory toys. She also, you know, has to confront, as do the other villagers, you know, the militarists of the time in Japan invading and other things. But I was just really struck by the beauty of the toys she made and the attention the directors were paying to the actual material process of her making those toys and sharing them, you know, with not only her fellow villagers, but the audience in the theater.
Was it ironic that it should be a woman toy maker? I usually picture male toy makers in popular culture.
You know, it's funny. It didn't strike me as such, I think, because it was presenting it as a home industry. It was something that she was making in the home and then turning over to these male street peddlers to sell. So it was, in some ways, a really sort of traditional process,
right,
of manufacture. The woman in the home doing this as a sideline industry, and then you have these male peddlers, you know, fairly poor fellows, you know, putting them on a stick and hanging them all. And that was beautiful to see, too. And they were rallying around her, you know, and really enjoying her art and then going out and making their own living through it, too.
Describe some of her creations, things that fascinated you.
Oh, they're beautiful. They were all of these wooden hand-painted toys, many of which had some kind of a mechanical design, too, with strings and pulleys and the like. There's a great scene towards the beginning of the film where there is a local street merchant, and there's lots of children in the beginning of this film. And, you know, he's a bit of a bully, of a friendly kind, too, nothing too scary. But he and the kids get into a bit of a skirmish. And so the children are making these little toys or things where they can shoot, you know, shoot things at him, little pea shooters and the like, at this merchant, the street merchant. And so the toy maker sees this and is inspired. And so she goes back to her home shop and she puts together this wooden doll that's this street merchant. And he's this rotund fellow with a mask, and this doll that she creates with a mask that he's holding up in front of his face, which is exactly what the street merchant was doing to dodge the things that the kids were flinging at him.
Yeah.
And so if you pull a string, as I recall, it's been a little while since I've seen the film, but if you pull a string, you know, the mask will come up over this doll. And the film's beautiful because it shows these interspersed scenes of what was happening out on the street with the fellow putting something up to block his face and dodge the kids, and then the doll itself working just like him. So you can see life reflected in the toy. It was beautiful.
What was the moral point of the film? So we start with this craftswoman, this woman who was really skilled at making toys and not mass producing them. But she comes eventually to warn others, mass production is everywhere. Foreign import toys are flooding our markets.
Yeah, it's a complex and interesting film, but I think, you know, what she's trying to do is rally her fellow Chinese people to stand up for the nation. And in a way, she's lost in the course of that call. So you see this celebration of the handicrafts that she's doing and the toys that she's making, these folk toys, really. But in the end, what we're going to see is that there's also, in a sense, this celebration, too, of industrially produced toys. So we'll also see scenes where you'll see dolls being put together in factories. You'll see their heads rolling and their eyes being made and the arms put together with what we probably think of as these sort of modern style dolls, you know, these mass manufactured dolls. And in the film, what we're going to see is that it's going to be her son who's going to go on to take over that kind of industry. And that's a vision maybe of a modern China going forward. So the torch is being passed in a sense, although I think there's also some nostalgia and maybe a little bit of a sense of loss there, too, that's embedded in those folk toys as well as this character.
What did you come across in terms of how much toys are infused with our national identity, whether we know it or not, as we're little ones playing with them?
I think we think they are. I don't know if they really are or not, because they circulate so much. And in the end, I think toys are exactly what kids want to make of them, which is usually not at all what their parents or other adults, and especially marketers, think they're going to do with them or make of them. But when I look at it historically, I see a lot of adults talking about, you know, how toys correspond to a national character, especially if you look at the 19-teens and 20s. So in China, people were talking about, with an economy in China in the teens and 20s not doing so well, that Chinese toys weren't good enough and that they had to be made better. And what did that mean? Well, you know, if they're all made out of wood and straw and bamboo, then we need to find a way to actually, you know, make toys that are more like the ones we're importing, which are, you know, machine-made toys and factory-made toys. Like those cool warships coming out of Germany, you know, for kids to play with. Although sometimes those are critiqued, too, for being too complicated.
Were there other countries they also characterized by the kinds of toys that were being imported from there?
Yeah, there's one text I've seen that talks about it and actually does break it down into different countries. Germany is put at the forefront because it's having the most success and seems to have the longest history, you know, of an industry of toy making because, you know, it's so developed industrially in making toys, but also has a great tradition of craft in making toys. France is described as having beautiful toys that are clever, but maybe more fragile than German toys. And then China is usually the main focus still of these conversations, you know, and blame for toys that are somehow of inferior manufacture, and also that they need to improve their educational value. This was really, I think, the concern in the teens and 20s, because there was also a concern with improving China's educational system and, you know, and strengthening that for the future and for China's next generation.
It's so interesting because now we know China has produced maybe 90% of American-made toys. They're produced in China, shipped back over here. But that wasn't always the case. And it's so interesting that back in the 20s and 30s, China was urging itself to ramp up in industrial production of toys.
Yeah, it's really interesting because if anything, it was almost the opposite problem back then. Everyone was concerned about all the toys that were being imported into China. And what are we going to do if our children are playing with these foreign toys? And so there's this real concern about finding, you know, a native Chinese toy that can be both modern, but also truly Chinese for our kids to play with. That was a big topic of conversation in the 1920s.
What did they settle on as modern but Chinese?
You know, there isn't one individual toy that marked that, but it's more of a set of characteristics of toys. You know, how do we create something that is, educational and at the same time safe for them to play with? And one thing that was advocated by many educators at this time was, interestingly, a return to some of those handicraft toys in a way that I was talking about in relation to the film. Except bringing that into it's no longer about production of those things or having your kids produce them. It's not about the toy maker, you know, making them to sell to your kids. But instead, it's about moms and their kids at home making them together in the 1930s, especially. And this is part of pedagogy and education. So kids and parents and teachers, you know, making their own toys out of bamboo and straw and learning from them.
That's interesting because you think of the Waldorf educational principle of parents and children making things out of yarn and natural goods, right?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of cross conversation going on at the same time between American educators and psychologists and Chinese specialists in those same fields too. So I don't think that's an accident. I mean, one of the things that I think is really interesting about it is the way it relates to, you know, how the family is also changing in this time in the 20s and 30s. So, you know, you have, I think, this real celebration of a new kind of middle-class family and a new kind of nuclear family in the 1930s. And it's all about, you know, the household and play and the mother and her children. At least that's what some of these toy writers are talking about.
It's interesting. You grew up with your mother as a daycare provider. Tell me about what sort of toys you grew up with that you remember and whether you think that was influenced by who your parents were.
Oh, that's really interesting. You know, I grew up with a whole range of toys. My father was born in Germany in a small village in the Alps way back when in the 1930s. And so his toys, a lot of those were actually handmade. And I have pictures of him as just this little toddler himself, you know, playing with these wooden toys, you know, and little spools and blocks and things that his father, who was a gardener and an artisan, I think made for him. The ways in which we can think about those meanings being handed down, both from adults to kids, but then, you know, across generations, I think that's really important. What I see is that adults are sort of pinning their whole future on it.
What do you mean by the adults pinning their future on these toys?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is that you have these elites actually writing this, creating these books, teaching people how to create these dolls with their kids, and promising them that if they engage in this kind of activity, if they make toys with their kids, they're going to help build a stronger China. And so I'm really interested in how that activity, making toys with your kids, can be seen as a patriotic thing to do, as a build the stronger nation activity.
So it was both a kind of buy China first.
Right.
But also a spend quality time and nostalgically make these beautiful artisanal toys that we've always known have been made here.
Yeah, I mean, I think we frame it as beautiful artisanal toys because we're looking back, you know, through a looking glass of time and that they're almost museum quality for us today. But I think at the time back then, what they saw was these things are, you know, made of just simple materials and they're not as shiny and new or as advanced as those factory-made toys. But we need to remember that they're Chinese toys and that they do have quality. And if we make them right, they can help us compete. And so bamboo and straw can actually be educationally useful and can help us make stronger kids. And stronger kids are our most important national good. That was the message back then.
Susan Fern Zubner is a professor of history at the University of Mary Washington. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. For months, companies and experts have been suggesting we hurry up and buy our Christmas gifts. Well, it's almost Judgment Day. Will they arrive in time? Erica Marciak is a professor of supply chain management at Old Dominion University. She says the pandemic is one thing, but our supply chain issues are another. We're importing almost everything these days, and it takes time for things to travel by land, sea, and air to get to our front stoop. Erica, we've all been warned to buy extra early this year due to supply disruptions, but how bad is it? Are late shoppers in trouble, do you think, at this point in the season?
Well, I think that late shoppers are always going to have some sorts of trouble simply because of the procrastination. but they should be able to still get items. It may not be their first choice, but I always say if you can be more creative, then you'll be more satisfied.
We've all seen the images of container ships waiting at sea, especially in California, to offload goods. Why exactly did that happen? We get that there's a backlog. We get that it's hard to solve. What led to it?
I would say COVID exacerbated a problem that we already had in that we don't make a lot of stuff.